This podcast contains lots of swearing and violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
Someone will call us up and say, hey, my friend works at this Pizza Hut, and this fucking Nazi works there, and he's always fucking with her. And so we would go to the Pizza Hut, we would wait there, and when they get off work, we'd follow them home. And then follow them to another home. And then we'd stake that place out. And we would just start making connections. All of a sudden, we had this network. It was all scribbled out on a notepad that had like 20 different addresses on it with the major, major hitters on their side. All the Youth of Hitler guys, Aryan Front, American Front. We had all these people's names and addresses just from following people around because we were patient. Our Friday nights would be, okay, four of us get together and we go sit out in front of the house, drink a couple beers and talk shit and listen to music and, ooh, someone's coming. Here they go. Okay, let's follow them to the next house. And then when they're going to try and meet up somewhere, we can dismantle their cars so they can't get there and make it really difficult for them to organize.
This is Jason from Portland's chapter of Anti-Racist Action.
The week before they were all supposed to go to Aryan Nations, we just grab a bunch of Jolly Ranchers and go from house to house to house, putting them in gas tanks so that they all had car trouble and they all had to pay a mechanics bill so that they didn't have as much income to take off for the weekend. We were willing to do a lot of things that a lot of the other groups would not do, or they didn't want to risk the physical scenario, much less getting caught and then having to answer to the police. We are totally willing to do this, and we'll do it so that you don't have to. I'm a white male. I'm going to make myself a target. We made some risky endeavors to get information that was not available. These friendships that were made early on led to, of course, Jonathan calling me up and being like, hey, man, I got to go dig through some trash, and I would really like to have a couple people with me. You got it. Let's go. We had intel on everybody. We were a little obsessed, but we knew it had to be done.
In our last episode, we looked at the house defense work of the Coalition for Human Dignity, where activists discreetly supported Portlanders targeted by white nationalist violence. In this episode, we offer another example of the coalition's dedication to using a diversity of tactics in the fight to drive white nationalist organizing out of Portland.
We'll hear about the far less public side of the Coalition for Human Dignity, digging through trash, following known racist skinheads, and sabotaging vehicles. The CHD also sent undercover agents to white nationalist meetings and gatherings on delicate and dangerous missions. A wall of secrecy existed between the community-based activities of the coalition and their intelligence work. Who are the people who masterminded and took these risks? What did they do with the information they gathered? I'm Mike Crenshaw.
And I'm Selena Flores, your host for It Did Happen Here, Episode 7, A Research Capacity. By the early 1990s, the Coalition for Human Dignity had shrunk in size but sharpened its focus. Within the broad coalition, a core group of anti-racists publicly confronted neo-Nazis in pickets and marches, organized house defenses, and nurtured ties to street-level anti-racist groups like Anti-Racist Action and Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. Early on, the CHD identified intelligence gathering as a key part of its mission to expel white power racists from the city. They collected reports from citizens who observed neo-Nazi activity in workplaces and neighborhoods. They worked closely with the Homophobic Violence Documentation Project hotline run by the Lesbian Community Project to identify and address hate crimes. And they collected intelligence on the hundreds of neo-Nazi and far-right groups organizing throughout the Pacific Northwest.
A key figure in this intelligence work was Jonathan Mazzocchi. We heard from him throughout the series. Mazzocchi was a fixture of the Coalition for Human Dignity. Stories place him on the street confronting cops and racists, helping with trainings, organizing large protests. But his passion was digging into the white power movement to learn who they were, where they would be, and how to take them down. Jonathan was a Lewis and Clark student involved in Central American solidarity and socialist politics. His highly principled anti-fascism and detail-oriented approach to fighting the right comes through in his speech, and it's clear that he has the temperament to organize an intelligence operation from the ground up. Jonathan Mazzocchi's comrades and allies speak with great respect of his commitment to the fight against fascism, Right-wing websites to this day post about him with deep hatred.
The Coalition for Human Dignity maintains something called The Shop.
The Shop was the name of the Coalition's intelligence headquarters, located in industrial North Portland.
Which was an office that housed 30 filing cabinets full of primary and secondary sources on far-right groups in our area of responsibility, which we took to be the Pacific Northwest. We had a very specialized library of more than 500 volumes. We had hundreds of videotapes and audio tapes. And then we had databases full of license plates from when we would send people to events to write down the license plates. And then we'd have to run them through the Oregon DMV. This would take time, and it was very labor intensive. One of the contrasts with some of the anti-fascist fight the right groups today is that a lot of that information can be got by online activists. That was not available back then. There were, at that time, hundreds of small papers throughout the region that would include in them letters to the editor, stories by beat reporters, so on and so forth. And if you wanted to get those stories, you had to subscribe to a clipping service, which would take, you know, keywords like white supremacist or anti-immigration. So the service would have someone cut out a whole bunch of clippings, put them into a packet, and then mail them to us. And once we would get them weeks later, we would index them and then put them into a database so that we could monitor them and begin to understand what it was they were doing. So my point here is that that's a lot of volunteers, a lot of labor, and it was a very different information environment. So in order for us to be competent, we had to have funding, we had to have support, we had to have people with basic library science skills. So that's what we did. And so this work was carried out by myself and a few other people. And the late Stu Albert, who was a somewhat famous yippie from the 60s, was instrumental in the Coalition for Human Dignity. He was on our board in training and helping people like me develop these skills with intelligence gathering. Stu died a few years ago. I miss him terribly. But he was a wonderful link also to 1960s radicalism and what was then the contemporary left.
Another key figure in developing the Coalition's intelligence work was Leonard Zeskin, author and research director at the Coalition's parent institution, the Center for Democratic Renewal. Zeskin is referred to here by Jonathan as Lenny.
It was Lenny's style of organizing a research-driven local unit. That's primarily his idea. Lenny has a better grasp of all of this, I think, than virtually anyone, really anywhere.
And here's Leonard.
This work takes time and energy, and it takes the ability to, if you're developing the information or organization, it takes months. It doesn't take days. It takes months and sometimes years to develop good information. CHD was willing to do it.
What Zeskin champions is the belief in a community's ability to organize locally, that anyone can be trained to fight against the right, and that community defense is strongest when it originates from a local base. National watchdog organizations like the Anti-Defamation League or the Southern Poverty Law Center use the top-down centralized power structure where local groups were guided by a national headquarters. The CHD's intelligence work, on the other hand, worked on building intelligence and community strength from the grassroots of the communities themselves.
We argued that research should be local and should be carried out in local communities by local people. Local communities have it within their power to monitor their own racists. It's local people who know best what's going on in their communities in order to knit together all of that research and all of that monitoring. We became a regional source to do that. And that meant training and working with hundreds of people in different communities who were tracking all of these groups.
Here is Stephen Gardner, the Coalition's intermittent executive director that we met in episode 3.
Three or four people working full time can't do all of this research. So we trained community researchers, one or two people in each town where there was some kind of activity happening. This ended up being a whole bunch of trainings around the Northwest, basically overviewing the picture of the far right in the Pacific Northwest, what kinds of activities were happening, what communities could do to respond. We were always big believers in informing your community who might target your community, what kinds of ideas, what kinds of ideologies, what kinds of tactics before there was a high-profile hate crime or a march that made the press or something like that.
Again, Jonathan Mazzocchi.
Because the far right was a social movement, and by that we meant it wasn't part of the state. Most of these people were organizing outside of government. They were in citizens groups, grassroots, far right organizations. Because they were organized in that fashion, it gave us a unique opportunity. We did training sessions to develop skills to research the far right, and some of that research involved infiltrating them, sending people to meetings. We call this broadly having a research capacity or an intelligence capacity.
What did infiltration look like for the Coalition for Human Dignity? For some, it meant going deep undercover into far-right groups. Other infiltration tactics were simpler. One person trained as an infiltrator and field researcher was Devin Burghardt, a young college student from rural eastern Washington who today investigates right-wing fascism at the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights.
I became involved while I was going to school up at Western Washington University. Jonathan Mazzocchi and Stephen Gardner came to do a presentation where I was going to school, and they mentioned the fact that the organization had internships. I immediately jumped at the chance. I was super excited. I was very much intrigued and wanting to do something to kind of push back against the rise of hatred and bigotry. So I immediately signed up and got involved. From the very beginning, they put me to work going to militia meetings and Klan rallies and other types of events around the region to try to gather the really important investigative research that the organization had become known for. I had the privilege of being one of the first interns that the organization brought in as they had moved from that exclusively grassroots organizing efforts that took off after the Seurat killings to taking on more of that role in the investigative and research side of things. CHD employ pretty much all of the investigative reporting techniques at our fingertips. And that includes the ability to infiltrate and go undercover at events to find out what far-right organizations are doing, to get beyond the public face that these organizations put forward, to find out what their real intentions are and what their real agendas are behind the scenes. The only way to do that is to infiltrate and go undercover. So the internship program helped train and equip me with some of the skills to be able to do some of that initial work, not the deep undercover work that's sometimes required, but the ability to go to public meetings and events and submit reports and write up about what was happening at those events to give a better sense for not only our organization, but other community organizations around the region about what was happening so they could get prepared for the next wave of activity rather than always having to worry about what had just happened.
What type of events did neo-Nazis hang out at? Stephen Gardner describes.
We sent people to rallies, or we went to rallies if it was a public event, or places where we knew that were not necessarily Nazi space, but where we expected to find them. And that would be punk shows, gun shows, and what became to be called preparedness expos, where survivalists gathered together to trade hints and buy mineral supplements and bayonets. People who would go to events for us, they had clean identities. They were not someone who had been published. This was a pre-internet time. So if you have a P.O. box and you're not an author or something like that, people could be pretty anonymous going to meetings and finding out what was going on directly from Nazis or from Christian patriots. There were probably another 20 to 30 people who were closely involved with us doing that from time to time.
At this point, the Coalition for Human Dignity was a busy, active organization. When Stephen talks about 20 people who operated in the capacity that Devin describes, that means 20 reports to file, 20 people to track that they got home safely, 20 people who maintained a clean identity, That's a lot, especially when we consider that intelligence was just one branch of the organization. Remember, too, the coalition supported people in deep undercover who infiltrated nationally organized neo-Nazi groups. People continue to maintain silence about that work, so there's not a lot we can tell you about it. Coalition activist Abby Layton describes how her work in the CHD was supported by the intelligence.
When we first started out, we actually had these beautiful young people who volunteered to infiltrate. There were quite a few of these brave young people, anti-racist skinheads, who infiltrated into these groups, especially Tom Metzger's group and some of the later groups that formed from Tom Metzger's activities here. So we had direct access the minute that there was any information, it came to us.
The Reverend Cecil Charles Prescott was one of the CHD board members back in the 1990s. He's an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ and a brother in the Order of Corpus Christi, and is currently the director of faith formation at Ainsworth United Church of Christ in Portland. Here he describes how CHD's intelligence work supported community defense.
One of the strengths of the Coalition for Human Dignity was the research, which was very, very good. And at the time was rare in terms of finding accurate information rather than, those are Nazi, we hate them. And coming to an understanding their background, who are the different players and individuals, their individual history, how they connect, where there are differences among those groups, and also where could you possibly find weak spots? If there were tensions between individuals, how do you work that to diffuse their power and their influence? It just occurred to me that was probably a tactic that was used in terms of knowing who these people were and how to respond to their fears and to their hopes and how to attack them differently.
Again, Devin Burkhart.
It was intense. You always have to be alert and concerned about your security and the security of others. But it was also enlightening because it really helped dispel a lot of the mythology that I think a lot of us have around neo-Nazis and far-right activists in general. It helps both show the human face of the other side and also introduced me to how they interact with one another, how various factions and schisms, how they look at the opposition, how their paranoia impacts all of their activity. All of those kind of things are really illuminating to see. But what was really, I think, at the core is you really saw, once you got behind the scenes, how much race and racism and anti-Semitism really were at the core, driving a lot of this stuff. Even though when they were talking to the public, they tried to often cover up or downplay that stuff. And then I think what was really most informative was seeing the impact that you could have of exposing what was going on behind the scenes to the larger public and being able to use that information to make a difference on what those organizations were going to do and how they were going to try to impact local communities. And that's always an uphill battle. It requires a lot of really hard work to have the data to show that, look, here's the details. We can tell you exactly what's happening, how many people are doing it, what's going on, what to look for, and how you prepare for it.
Imagine the work. Activists attended meetings where they sat among the white nationalists, took notes, wrote down who was present, collected license plates, made relationships, then wrote up and submitted reports. These reports were then analyzed for commonalities.
The Coalition for Human Dignity's research arm eroded the denial and propaganda offered by the mainstream news sources. It was the CHD's goal to prove that the speeches of the white nationalists concealed a far more violent threat to peace and public safety than anyone, public or private citizen, wanted to know existed. The surveillance Devin and others provided offered a clearer proof of intent to harm. Again, here's Jonathan Mazzocchi.
We did a program of infiltration focused on the Oregon citizens' lives.
The Oregon Citizens Alliance was a fundamentalist anti-choice Christian group rooted in homophobia that in the early 1990s dominated Oregon Republican Party politics. The OCA represented itself as a mainstream organization within acceptable politics while legislatively dismantling human rights of queer Oregonians. The Coalition for Human Dignity toiled for years against the Oregon Citizens Alliance.
You know, the Oregon Citizens Alliance in the late 80s, they had already successfully overturned a governor's order banning discrimination in public employment. They had already succeeded in doing that by the time that they made this ballot measure statewide that would have banned LGBTQ rights within public employment. And you got to understand that, you know, on the left, among many liberals and progressives, the Christian right was often treated as something that was from the past, that we had overcome, and not politically relevant, that they were just dismissed as an irrelevant political force. Back then, we were like, no, that's not the case. These movements have always been with us. They will always be with us, and they always must be fought. So with the Oregon Citizens Alliance, which was becoming more politically powerful, we managed to secure their full donor lists, internal memos, and all kinds of information. But some of that was very, very important in getting a better picture of who their donors were, what their social class backgrounds were, demographics of their donors. Also, you get a sense of the culture within the political organization when you get to read their memos. We wanted to know what they were eating for breakfast. We wanted to know everything about them. You do because that makes it easier to fight them.
We've heard how the intelligence was used against white nationalist movements. What tactics did the CHD use locally to expose and discourage individual racists? Here's Stephen Gardner, an anti-fascist activist, M. Treloar.
The most effective things were direct interventions. Now, that included Sharp/ARA confrontation, but it also included if they have a public event to show up with many more people than they did and confront them more rhetorically. That included outing them. This was a strategy to make them visible in the community. So to call up employers and say, look, do you know you have a Nazi working for you doing customer service who has visible swastika tattoos? Do you really want that? We had a known violent skinhead who was living in an apartment complex where there were vulnerable people. We would call up the landlord and say, look, this is a person with a history of violence. Within the applicable fair housing laws, do you really want this person living in your space? And usually what they would do is they would look at it and say, huh, this person is having a party every weekend and trashing the walls with hammer blows. Maybe we have good cause to ask them to go elsewhere. And so what happened with some of these tactics is it kept them from congregating in the city of Portland. Many of them were pushed out into the suburban areas where they were more diffuse and where, especially at the time, was much wider anyway, so there was less of an intimidation factor. Then I think in terms of dealing with the boneheads, having a broad set of people we could reach out to in the community beyond the street level confrontation to say, look, this is a real problem. It may not be that you're seeing them, but this is our city. We always tried to think, okay, who's going to be most vulnerable? And, you know, how can we do whatever it takes to move these folks away from the most vulnerable communities?
Then the other thing we did that was a little bit more controversial within the group was we said they can't hold a job. If we find out that they have a job anywhere within 50 miles, we'll show up and we'll tell their coworkers. We did that several times. So folks would call in and say, so-and-so's a Nazi and he's working here. And we'd say, okay, we'll investigate it. And it was not always true, but it was true often enough that we could say, okay, let's get together 50, 60 people and show up at the Olive Gardens and we're going to picket there. And we would have their name and, if possible, their photo on a flyer. And we would say, here's what they did. Public information, and we'd say, this is what we know about this person. He's working here. We would leaflet the coworkers first. And then we would tell the manager, we're going to be here. Everybody who eats here and works here deserves to know you got a Nazi in the back room. And that drew people towards us, gave us credibility, and gave us a sense of what we're doing matters, because it did. Every time we did it, they lost their job, and I'm proud of that. It drove them out of where they were and made their lives more difficult. We would talk to them through secondary sources. We just put the word out. If you don't want this to happen, all you have to do is say, I'm no longer part of this grouping. If you drop out of this grouping, we'll leave you alone. If you stay part of this grouping, we're going to make your life hell wherever we find you. Some of them, it probably pushed them more so into the grouping, as in, everybody hates me, therefore I'm going to stick with my Nazi brothers. Many of them quit. There were 200, 300 Nazi boneheads in the area at one point, and the ones who did not go to prison drifted away. And they drifted away because their choices were either form a new tightly knit grouping or cease to be part of this so I can get on with my life. You can say there was a generational choice, but some of them, they hunkered down and eventually became Volksfront.
We debriefed people who didn't want to be Nazis anymore. So we spent a lot of time with anyone who wanted to come out, asking them, you know, why did they get in and what kinds of activities were their groups involved in it, what are your biggest concerns, and so on. And again, when it came to ex-Nazis, we were like, if you were once a Nazi, it's not enough just to say, I'm no longer a Nazi. You can't be neutral in this particular fight. It's not ethically tenable. If you're going to come out, you're going to come all the way out and tell what you know.
A thorn in the side of both the CHD in general and Jonathan Mazzocchi in particular was Portland cop Lauren Christensen, a Portland Police Bureau member and a high-level influencer within the state's gang task force. Christensen was despised amongst Portland leftists as he undercut the hard work of anti-fascist groups, including the CHD, by repeatedly associating anti-racist skinheads and punks with racist skins, muddling them all together as youth gang culture rather than as specific subcultural groups. Jonathan Mazzocchi relates a personal triumph in his intelligence career.
One of the things I did personally that the Coalition for Human Dignity is not responsible for, but that I did is I managed to get a hold of Lauren Christensen's unredacted internal intelligence reports. I managed to get those over a period of, I think, 6 months or a year. And then we used that information to have a more effective means of fighting these racist groups. So these intelligence reports, so you understand, every time a cop came up upon a racist skinhead group and then interviewed them or arrested them or whatever, it would go into these summarized intelligence reports. The names, addresses, workplaces, social security, and there was just a wealth of data in there. I managed to get a steady stream of those reports. And then we used them to fight these guys. When I was stealing his reports, it also gave us a better way to contradict him in the press. When he was saying, oh, this group, they're just a bunch of kids, they're nothing. We were like, well, actually, you know, they were all at an Aryan Nations compound last weekend working with very professional neo-Nazis. That doesn't sound like wayward youth. That sounds pretty serious. So it helped us politically make our argument also.
Tending to and developing diverse relationships is another important part of the effort. Here's Devin again.
It was, in fact, the research that told us that it was going to require a multiplicity of tactics, you require direct action, you require organizing to expose and confront white supremacists when they were rallying and holding public events, because that sent a message that the community wasn't going to remain silent and that Portland was no longer going to be a fertile recruiting ground for folks in the wake of white supremacist activity, that they weren't alone, that they could face the fear together. But it was really important also to expose their activities in which white supremacists were targeting for new recruits. So in essence, trying to inoculate communities that were vulnerable to white supremacist recruitment to get them to draw a bright line, to exclude white supremacists from their subculture or from their organizing or fermenting their other work. I think what was really important is to get more people to take it seriously. Because back then, it was really hard. It was often dismissed as local street gang activity. It was dismissed as harmless graffiti. But by doing effective and long-term research and organizing on it, you could show the larger community that this was, in fact, politically motivated, that it was designed to harass and intimidate Jews and people of color. It was designed to bring about the kind of society that white supremacists had dreamed of. And you could also then expose people to the larger networks and organizations that were providing aid and support. That was effective in getting more people to take the stuff seriously, from city government to law enforcement to everyone else. Removing it from simply the fight for the streets to making it a fight for the kind of heart and soul of the entire city.
The Coalition for Human Dignity struggled constantly to communicate the dual threat posed by Christian fundamentalists and white nationalists. No one, it seemed, would take seriously the intelligence, which consistently indicated that combined, these two right-wing movements could shake democracy to the core.
The Coalition for Human Dignity had two unique contributions. First was to recognize that the vigilante far right, that the threat of an American form of fascism, would come through the Christian right and the white supremacist movement. And while that doesn't sound provocative or in any way controversial today, back then actually was, because most groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League and other mainstream, more liberal groups really treated those two movements very differently. So their focus tended to be on the white supremacist movement, the Ku Klux Klan, racist skinheads, militia groups, so on and so forth. Anti-LGBTQ stuff was not considered hate group activity. The racist anti-immigrant work was also not considered, broadly speaking, hate group activity. So one of the things we argued very early on was that actually you need to take a look at both of these political trends within the far right. When you look at them, it becomes very apparent that in order to achieve any kind of broader equality, in order to move forward, we need to fight both of those political currents. So that's what we did. And if you look at the Coalition for Human Dignity's research, you'll see very early on that we made a distinction between these two political currents, but also said that they had to be struggled against. Again, you really had organizations fighting one or the other, but not both.
A major strength of the Coalition for Human Dignity was their willingness and resilience to experiment with their tactics. Stephen Gardner outlines the process.
We'll try this, we'll try that. And to then say, okay, we think this will work, but we're not going to do this on our own. We can do research on our own, but we weren't trying to be right. We were trying to have an impact. And so then we would go to community organizations, usually the most impacted, that might be the Jewish community, if this is a Holocaust denial situation. Or the Black community, if this is a situation with street intimidation, or the queer community, if this was a OCA thing, we would say, we're thinking about doing this. What do you think? Or what would be helpful to you? So we tried to do movement-facing partnerships to inform our activities. I wouldn't say that we always succeeded. I mean, a lot of us were pretty young back then who were involved. There's a certain arrogance of youth that sometimes made us think that we were smarter than everyone else. And we certainly spent a lot of time figuring things out about the right, reading their newsletters. And so in a certain sense, especially in a pre-internet time, we did know more about what was going on with the right than anyone else in the Northwest by virtue of having 14 filing cabinets full of their newsletters. That doesn't necessarily translate into winning. We won some fights and we lost others.
At the beginning of this episode, Jason referred to his involvement with the research as a little obsessed. The mindset of the white nationalists became, for some, omnipresent in their actual lives, a virtual reality with hate at its core. This took a toll on the organizers, who lived with regular death threats and harassment, while media and local agencies downplayed the threat of racist violence. Stephen Gardner explains the intimate relationship coalition activists had with the far-right world.
who would routinely call me up and threaten my life, threaten my family. Not just me, this was other people in the organization as well, whoever they could get in touch with. That was the kind of organization we were in. We were constantly confronting and being confronted by political vigilantes who we knew to be violent.
Abby Layton gives us some more details.
My friend Jonathan, who taught me to stand up for myself, received a rat in the mailbox. It had been shot through the head. It said, "This will happen to you if you do any more of your work." I got letters and phone calls about twice a week for several years. Also, I got copies of the newsletters, the neo-Nazi newsletters that were sent out nationally. In those newsletters, my address and another one of my co-workers' addresses were on the newsletter saying, "Drop in, give her a visit. I'm sure she'd love to meet you." I was willing to risk my life doing this. And I don't know that I'm not really a big risk taker. It was just really super important to me, the work. Like, after my daughter survived that attack, which she might not have, I was in shock for about a week. But then after that, I just sobbed. It was so scary to me. I've said over and over again to hold your own hand when you're scared, but I guess I want people to know that there's a great threat here, that these people really are dangerous. The work can get very, very scary. It can get very life and death. And I want to encourage each person to find their own place in it. Like, you don't have to be on the lines. You don't have to, you don't have to force yourself past where you feel at your edge. Just go to where your edge is. That'll be enough.
For a small, poorly funded organization, the CHD has left a powerful legacy. The work of the research activists lives on in many organizations who called on them for help and in the lives of activists themselves. Throughout this podcast, we hear people referring to the work of the CHD as being hard work, but most of the CHD activists we interviewed about their experiences are fighting white supremacy and white nationalism today. When Devin Burkhart encountered the Coalition for Human Dignity at the meeting at Western Washington University, he could not have predicted the impact it would have on his life.
I've been working professionally on white nationalism for over 25 years now. I started at the Coalition for Human Dignity. And what's important about CHD is what an important role that that small Portland and Seattle-based organization played in helping shape the research capacity and the desire to do that work in other organizations, groups like the Montana Human Rights Network and the North Carolinians Against Racial and Religious Violence, and numerous other local groups were trained and supported by CHD back in those days. And it was CHD that, after my working with them for about 4 years, CHD got a call from an affiliated organization in Chicago who was just starting up, and they really wanted to add a research capacity. The group was called the Center for New Community. CHD gladly decided to volunteer me to go out there and work for a couple months to help them set up that organization and help them build their research capacity. And it was after doing that for a couple months, we decided that it would be best for me to stay on and help build up that organization. So, in many ways, the work that the Center for New Community did for over two decades was in large part seeded and grown by the work that CHD and others were doing. And we couldn't have done it without their support and their training and the kind of vigilance that they provided on the ground. It really inspired that work and continues to inspire the work we do at the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights.
Today, with Proud Boys shooting protesters, presidents displaying fascist behavior and speech, Christian fundamentalists gaining mainstream political power and threatening basic reproductive and other human rights, researching far-right hate groups is just as urgent as when boneheads chased Abby Layton's daughter onto Mary Steiger's porch. Again, Jonathan Mazzocchi.
So today, groups are carrying that out through doxing, through deplatforming. And they're very effective, and they're effective in ways that we really never could be. And I have a great deal of respect for that work. I would say one thing, it's not a criticism, what we call signals intelligence or internet hacking, doing intelligence work online, is one form of research-driven politics. But the other form is human intelligence, where you actually have people go to their meetings, where people befriend these folks so that we can steal their membership lists, so we can have a better idea of what the internal culture of their politics are, what their political organizations are, so we can have an understanding of where their funding comes from, so we can track and monitor, for instance, when they're supporting a Trump candidacy, you know, months before the guy is going to run for office. We need to have that information. And one of the ways that's very effective in doing that is developing people to go and do that. Contemporary Fight the Right groups are far more effective at signals intelligence and utilizing the internet, but perhaps not quite as good as we were at developing people to infiltrate those groups. We need to do both.
And finally, a message to activists on the front lines today.
If there's anything that I would tell contemporary activists, it's really push the envelope. You're going to need to do this. Because if you don't, you're relying on other outfits to do that intelligence gathering for you. And if they do it, then it's going to be their political interpretation of what that stuff means. You don't want that. We need to have control of our own intelligence. We need to have control of our own research. And that's what we did. We didn't rely on outside groups to come in and tell us what the threat was that we were facing. We did the research and we knew what it was. And therefore, we had a better means of a counterforce of organizing against it.
Quick, long, hiding shadows. Exit home in the scoopy for light. Break through, smash, there's a feature, what's a dive? Smiles to staple as my eyes go down in shape. Running in the shadows.
Thanks for listening to episode 7 of It Did Happen Here, A Research Capacity. There are show notes with links, transcripts, and other relevant content at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. You can also listen to the podcast on the KABU website and on Spotify, YouTube, and Apple Podcasts. This episode, interviews were by Annette Newell, Claire Rigiotto, Selena Flores, and Aaron Yankee, and your hosts were Selena Flores and Mike Crenshaw. This podcast is produced by Selena, Mike, and me, Aaron Yankee. Our next episode, Sharper Times, will be released January 8th. You'll hear about the role played by skinheads against racial prejudice in conjunction with Anti-Racist Action and the Coalition for Human Dignity. Music in this episode is by Anatech from the Free Music Archive and the Neo Boys. Thanks to the bands for the music. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories and experiences. Thanks to the Marla Davis Fund, KABU Community Radio, and the rest of our production team, Mo Baustern, Icky A, and Julie Perini. And thank you for listening.
Rolling in the gutter. Rolling in the shadows. Exit home and escape from light. Break through, smash, cause I'll beat you to a pulp. Smiles to disable as my eyes go down in shape. Rolling in the shadows. Rolling in the gutter. Rolling in the shadows.